Good morning. I'm Ken Rosenthal from the CME Committee. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Eduardo Martinez de Boucher. He's a critical care medicine specialist in Miami and has been practicing for 22 years. He graduated from the University of Miami School of Medicine in 1997, specializes in critical care medicine, hospice, and palliative medicine, and currently he's the medical director of telehealth at the EICU Transfer Center. Today's topic is evidence-based clinical care, surviving sepsis. Please join me in welcoming Dr. de Boucher.
Good morning, everybody. Again, Eddie Martinez de Boucher. I do, as he mentioned, the telehealth center for Baptist for our six facilities down south thus far. And a medical director of our EICU, electronic ICU. For those that don't know what that is, that's camera monitoring of all our ICU beds and step-down beds across our system with the 24/7 attending present there, both for the facilities that have 24/7 in-house intensivists and those that don't for evening coverage and ensuring best practices when our attendings are busy running around the system. They take a look at all the admissions. But can ask me more about that later. Today I'm here to talk about sepsis. It's a topic that's very close to my heart because it's something that I feel has a lot of potential and opportunity for improvement. I have no disclosures. Dr. Cata Jimenez will talk about documentation afterwards, and she doesn't have any disclosures either. So I want to talk about how we're identifying sepsis across our system currently. Take a look at the evidence-based practices that we're currently using, the ones CMS is actually requiring us to follow, and describe what we're doing currently in Baptist Health South Florida in order to meet these initiatives and improve mortality, cost of care, and length of stay across our system. So first I want to talk about, usual talks are about identifying sepsis go through a lot of complicated criteria. But when we look at the most recent definition for sepsis, it's a dysregulated host response to infection. And when you really think about this, which it makes sense, a dysregulated host response, but you think about the actual management that we're doing across our system and across the country, nobody's really addressing this dysregulated host response. So currently, we're really still in the Stone Age of sepsis. I'd like you all to think of sepsis the same way that we're thinking of cancer, which is that patients that have cancer have multiple different genetic factors that lead to those cancers. They have multiple different alleles that lead to how they respond. This is the same thing with sepsis. We're treating sepsis currently as one diagnosis, when it could potentially be multiple phenotypes of different genomic allele expressions of where people have difficulties in their management with significant diseases that they're exposed to. So for instance, somebody may come down with H1N1 and go into ARDS and renal failure, and another person may clear it in a couple of days, and most of us have said, oh, they just got the combination to the antibody quicker. I think it's a little bit more than that. And right now, when we've applied medicines towards the dysregulated host response, we looked at activated protein C, for instance, which was Zygris, which is no longer on the market. Jean-Louis Vincent, which recently visited us, did a trial on thrombomodulin. These things were to address a dysregulated host response, but they basically addressed it on a population of patients as if they were the same population. And potentially, these are different phenotypic expressions where patients may have different genetics or genetic expressions because of other factors that they have, obesity, alcoholism, whatever's going on, where some of them may have benefited from some of those therapies and some of them not, but we yet don't know how to identify those patients. And we were basically doing what would be equivalent to people giving HER2 drugs to every single type of cancer patient, you know, as opposed to actually targeting individual patients by figuring out their phenotypes, crossing their genomic expression, and figuring out where they actually have difficulties with their dysregulated host response. So unfortunately, currently our management is still infection control and organ support, which is why we're in the Stone Age. But that being said, the mortality for sepsis is declining by improving that management. So at minimum, we need to make sure that we're doing the best we can on this Stone Age management of sepsis, because there's still space to diminish mortality across our country. So I wanted to start with a case. And you're obviously at a sepsis lecture, so you know this is going to be a sepsis case. But I want you in your mind to think about, when would you have actually decided that this patient possibly has an infection? And when would you have triggered to draw lactic acid, draw blood cultures, and give some empiric antibiotics? I mean, be truthful as you're looking at this case, because this is very typical. So we have a 62-year-old female brought by family to the emergency department with a history of syncope at home. She states she has felt a doleful feeling in her left lower abdomen for 4 days, and this morning had 3 bloody bowel movements, leaving her feeling weak and dizzy. She has taken nothing by mouth except sips of tea today. All right. So on HPI, and I'm going to bring it out there, is there anything in there that how many people seeing this patient in the emergency department with just this information would have done blood cultures and given her antibiotics? Not many. That's the usual response. All right. Now, we're not going to change anything about her HPI. I'm just going to give you a little bit more information about her. So, a past medical history, hypertension managed with metoprolol, diet control, diabetes. She had an A1C 7.1 3 months ago and a BMI of 36. Breast cancer diagnosed this year. She's post-mastectomy, and her last chemotherapy was 4 weeks ago. She's allergic to penicillin, a rash after taking it for a few days 30 years ago for a dental procedure. I didn't change her HPI. I just gave you more information about her. How many people would have done blood cultures now and given her antibiotics? Okay, so there's a smattering of individuals that said yes, that they would have done that. But yet the HPI didn't change. What changes? Risk, right? The risk, so it's not in your, it's not your principal diagnosis in your differential yet, right, that she's septic. But you're scared of missing it, because there's something different about this patient that might put her at a higher risk of missing that diagnosis. So some of you already get into to where I'm thinking. The allergy, I just threw it out there for fun. I mean, if there's any ID folk in the room, that's not a contraindication to giving her a penicillin-like agent if it's so needed, and if you thought that the patient was septic. So now, patient vital signs, 100 over 60, heart rate of 98, respirations 22, satting 100% on room air. She's low-grade temperature, and she's a little orthostatic when she stands up. Heart rate goes to 110. Conjunctiva are pale. We kind of expected that. Abdomen, palpable discomfort in the left lower quadrant, no rebound or guarding. Normal rectal, a little trace of blood when we on our glove. And her extremities are warm with easily palpable pulses. All right. So has anyone picked up on SIRS criteria? So when we're looking at the patient, her SIRS criteria, like every patient, can potentially be explained by other things, right? This patient could be bleeding. You're going to get tachycardic. Going to have an increased respiratory rate. There's a couple funny things here that sometimes don't make sense when we look at the patient. So if we thought she was in hemorrhagic shock or hypovolemic shock, we wouldn't expect the warm extremities, right, and the palpable pulses. And there's this low-grade temp, and most of the people are hypovolemic or hemorrhagic. They kind of get a little bit cold on us. If any of you do trauma, you see the patient's temperature drops pretty quickly. So some things don't make sense, but still, how many people believe that the differential diagnosis where sepsis would be at the top of the differential diagnosis for this patient? All right, I'm going to go to say, before I continue, that this patient is a conglomerate of 3 cases that were seen across our system. So I'll give you a little bit more. So chest x-ray, normal findings with a chemo port in good position. EKG, sinus tachycardia, changes consistent with left ventricular hypertrophy from her hypertension. Elevated troponin of 2.1. Does your ED do troponin on basically everybody? I sometimes feel that troponin is always drawn. But it's there, and sometimes you get these weird troponins, and you sit there asking yourself, which one of the 7 different things that cause that troponin elevated is the one that I'm worried about now? And the lab calls with what you're finally expecting, a critical hemoglobin of 6.2. When I talk about this case and the cases that we failed, I take a look at it and I said, you know, can these things be explained by a GI bleed? Absolutely. I said, but can we explain them from an infection and sepsis? And I said, yes, there's a potential here for that too. So did the patient have SIRS criteria? And we'll explain why that was important. Yes, they did. The patient was tachycardic. There was a high respiratory rate. We have two of them thus far. When we get further labs back, we get another source criteria, white count of 3.5. But you could tell me, oh, but she was on chemotherapy. We can explain that one away too, right? Because her bone marrow, you know, is taxed and she doesn't have, you know, an ability to make white blood cells. But there's three source criteria here. Labs, glucose of 195. She's a diabetic. Had she not been a diabetic and had hyperglycemia, that's an increased risk for mortality with sepsis. That's another thing to keep in mind. Creatinine, we expected a little elevated. BUN, a little elevated. Hemoglobin, 6.5, we knew. But here comes the kicker. IV fluids are given. Blood transfusions done. Her blood pressure continues to deteriorate. 88 over 50. Repeat hemoglobin appropriately goes up to 8.5 after 2 units. Urine output remains low at 30 ml per hour. At this point, how many people would do blood cultures and give her antibiotics? I think more, right, at this point. So the thing is, how long does it take to get all these things done in your emergency department with blood transfusion, with the fluid resuscitation? So when they're finally not responding, is it fair to say at minimum 3, 4 hours, 5 hours, maybe 6 sometimes if it's late in the evening to get the patient admitted? Why don't you keep that in mind as we go over these things? So bedside echo reports an EF of 30% globally depressed with left ventricular hypertrophy. That troponin could be an anthracycline she got from her chemotherapy, right? Could be sepsis, where it's elevated. That globally depressed EF could be sepsis also. Could it be ischemia? Sure. She's 62 years old. But everything here could be explained by sepsis. I don't know if you all have the rapid micro results. I think they're phenomenal. This is genetic testing of your cultures right out of your ED. This is great for de-escalation or even for identification of infection at an earlier period of time. So these tests take about 40 minutes to run. So the rapid micro results with positive gene expression for MRSA in her blood cultures and E. coli, 2 out of 2. She had a chemo port, right? And she's been actively getting chemo. So she has a MRSA infection. The E. coli, okay, so there's some translocation going on here from something going on in her abdomen. CT of the abdomen looks more like she's got some sigmoid inflammation, maybe a diverticulitis. If you put this case together, the patient looks like they probably had bacteremia ongoing from her line, was sicker, poor perfusion to the intestine, activated her diverticulitis, all right, and ended up translocating multiple bacteria. These are real cases. It's a conglomerate of different cases that we've had through our system. So you have to think about these patients. Patient had a pacemaker a week ago. Shows up a week later in CHF. It looks like CHF. Yeah, but you know what? There's a new vascular access device that was placed a week before. You always have to think, what is the cost? And we're going to talk about missing sepsis or delaying care in certain patients of sepsis and the patients that are at very high risk for death. What truthfully is the percentage cost for all those patients? That was one of the patients. That one did poorly. The chemotherapy patient with a port infection was a patient I rounded on in the ICU. I came in to see the patient in the ICU, and the patient had gastroenteritis for about 2 days, was in the hospital, but you know they were being purist about it. There's no infectious sources from the chemotherapy. Everything's fine. But there weren't any cultures done. And the patient was admitted to the unit after they aspirated. They vomited, they aspirated. I catch the patient in the unit on a vent, on pressors. That's how I walk on to see the patient. Yeah, it was a really bad code rescue. The patient aspirated from this non-infectious gastroenteritis, is what they said. But the patient's on Levofit at 50 mics. You know what? You know, how could we not have cultures? So I sent cultures, got the rapid response back. She had MRSA from her line. The following day, they called the patient had candida, too, at that point. And the patient died. And the question is, could we have gotten her out of that sepsis admission and brought her back to live, you know, a few more days and be with her family some more time before her metastatic disease got her? And when we think about sepsis, and I didn't start this discussion talking about incidence of disease, we're not going to diminish the incidence of sepsis. In case you don't know, we're all going to die one day, you know, so sepsis isn't going to disappear. It's going to still be the leading diagnosis, the leading cause of death, and probably the leading cause of readmission across all health systems. But the idea is to push it to later time in life, is to get through each initial episode of sepsis more often and get those patients out. And again, really be talking about end-of-life care and palliative care when we're talking about sepsis. That would be our goal for management of these diseases. And currently, unfortunately, the mortality, although somewhere in the 20 to 30% range, is still very high and potentially has a lot of improvement to be made. So SIRS criteria. The patient had SIRS. Heart rate greater than 90. Oh, but the patient had a GI bleed. Maybe. Core temperature low or high. White blood cell count less than 4,000. Oh, the patient was on chemotherapy. That's why they had that SIRS criteria. Respirations greater than 20. Why not 20? Because everybody's respirations in the hospital are at 20 ever since I've been a resident. So they know if the nurse puts 21, it's real. All right. So this is a busy slide, right? How do we screen for sepsis? We've gone through sepsis now for years, and in the studies, people have started to look at different things besides the initial St. John's criteria, which was SIRS plus organ system dysfunction plus a suspected source of infection. And people moved into the SOFA score, which is a sequential organ failure assessment score. But the SOFA score really was to tell us how sick were the patients with sepsis, what were their likelihoods to die from sepsis. And it's really good for trials to be able to differentiate amongst patients so you can match them better and know that you're not looking at a mild sepsis versus what the DRG's code as a severity of illness for, a severe sepsis with organ system dysfunction. But it's not really good for screening patients because what we need is a really good tool to get on these patients early because early management matters. So we're still kind of left with this SIRS business, which has low specificity. And then the other thing they came up with is they came up with a Q-SOFA score. And the Q-SOFA score basically was that you had to be positive 2 out of 3 of either altered mental status, increased respiratory rate, or systolic less than 100. And it's a great score to tell you if you have a high likelihood of death from sepsis, but the sensitivity in your ED is only 46%. And identification matters. So we get back to SIRS again, and everyone says, why are we still talking about SIRS? Well, because it's 83.6% sensitive if you're looking at SIRS criteria for identifying sepsis. The problem is that specificity, 25%. So if you look at other hospitals, we won't name them, that run around and they put in these code sepsis teams based on SIRS criteria, and all these people that are doing all this good work during the day have to run off 10 times a day in a whole team and go find these patients just to find out that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 of them maybe have sepsis. It's not an efficient way to practice medicine. So it's painful. What we did over in the Baptist Health System is we have this virtual sepsis unit. We're using those discrete data input fields from Cerner for the St. John's sepsis alerts and the organ system dysfunctions, which are discrete data input fields in Cerner also. And we have an APRN offsite taking a look at these alerts and then calling in, validating whether they're real or not, eating the low specificity before we put boots on the ground and start deviating everybody from their good work that they're doing at the bedside. So it's efficient. And they also serve as a system-wide sepsis coordinator that basically is on top of meeting all the criteria that CMS demands, but also the actual good care that they need in a timely fashion. So this is what we put together to dent our mortality. And our CMS at our hospitals, our CMS compliance has gone well above 80-something percentile, which is the top 10th percentile in the country. And as of last, when we started looking at our data for mortality across the system, it's all coming down. So the mortality for a sepsis diagnosis, for severe sepsis, is coming down across the system. So even though we all kind of knew what we needed to do, the actual process of mechanizing it and making sure we did it for all the cases we intended to do it in was the difficulty. So we employed what you're seeing here, the SIRS alert. The organ system dysfunction, these are the data you can pull from your Cerner, which is the lactate that's elevated, coagulopathies, bilirubin elevation, creatinine. Ugh, I hate creatinine. You know, by the time you get a creatinine bump, patient's been in renal failure for a while. So, you know, and we can't put a catheter in anybody anymore because Cowdy, you know, so we can't do that. So it becomes really difficult, but we have to be hypersensitive towards renal dysfunction because it is a window towards what's going on in the body. What's not here, as you see, is encephalopathy, which is not a discrete data input field. But as you saw from QSOFA, it really denotes high mortality. So we really have to keep in mind when patients are encephalopathic that That's an organ system dysfunction, and it's a bad one. And that's a patient that we really need to jump on. So if you have SIRS and encephalopathy, that's a big one. Respiratory failure is also hard to pick up from discrete data input fields. A lot of people put people on BiPAP, and it's hard to pick up what's going on through the Cerner. But that's another one also. So, and in addition, shock, obviously, systolic less than 90, MAPS less than 65, decreases in systolic blood pressure from baseline. Our patient that we presented had nothing to eat. Didn't take her BP meds. If grandma's blood pressure is normally 170 or 180 off her BP meds and she shows up 110, that's shock. We don't have to wait for it to be 90. She's hypoperfusing. So that's the other thing, is individualizing patient care and helping our nurses, our clinical nurses, identify these patients for us, because they're the ones that are really the front line. The other piece, the diagnosis of sepsis, well, if you put sepsis in the chart, the patient's diagnosed with sepsis. And that's fine. As I showed you, you know, there is non-SIRS sepsis, and there are patients that you can classify as having sepsis or septic shock. So putting those diagnoses in the chart, CMS makes sure that you, at the moment you put that diagnosis in the chart, that's time zero, and we must be compliant for the management and care of those patients in the same fashion as if we knew the discrete data inputs that actually were time zero. CMS requirements, you don't have to read that. But CMS requirements, this is mandated care for sepsis, all right? And why is it mandated? Because CMS said, at minimum, we need to address these patients in a timely fashion, identify them in a timely fashion. They want early antibiotic therapy, because I'll show you in a moment, it's proven to improve mortality. And they want some type of assessment on need for reperfusion or not, and how well they responded to it. So that's what the criteria are. First 3 hours from the diagnosis of sepsis, they need a lactic acid. You need to have blood cultures done in a timely fashion, all right, before the antibiotics. You need to give antibiotics. I'll tell you that for severe sepsis, you should be giving antibiotics within the first hour. But CMS, 3 hours for sepsis patients as a whole. And if they're in shock, administer 30 mL per kilo. It could be ideal body weight. I know we have an obesity epidemic, so ideal body weight. And shock is, again, what we talked about, the blood pressure parameters and elevated lactic acid, greater than 4. And what happens if your patient's in overt heart failure? CMS doesn't care, but we do. So if they're in heart failure, overt heart failure, not a diagnosis of heart failure, but overt heart failure, then you withhold it, but it counts against you, just as you're aware. Now, palliative care patients, you can document a palliative care consultation during that period of time, and if you don't want to give fluids to someone that looks like they're going to end up intubated and they're DNR2, that's fine. That's fine, but let's document, and they'd remove that from the equation. So this is CMS mandate. The other piece is, if you don't respond to fluids in a timely fashion, you need to start pressors. That's another CMS mandate also. So if you're getting active fluid resuscitation and you're still hypotensive, the literature really defends the use of early pressors, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. The remeasuring of the lactic acid, the follow-up within that six-hour period. So these are all the CMS mandate criteria. If you miss any one of these, you missed the SEP bundle. And at that point, it gets counted against you. And they're expecting us to be 79.4% compliant across all our patients for this. Levofed versus dopamine. I put this slide up here because some of our stepped-on units, they can use levofed. I mean, they could use dopamine, but they can't use levofed. And I found our people telling us, oh, you know, we don't have a bed, but we can put them on dopamine over on the floor, you know, for their septic shock. I said, problem with that is the literature really doesn't defend that. When it comes to levofed versus dopamine, these are meta-analysis of all trials done looking at these. And although you see the odds ratio crosses one, to the left favors levofed, and to the right favors dopamine, the weight of all these trials is to the left of that odds ratio of 1. So when you take them all together, which is the black diamond in each one of these here, for all-cause mortality, norepinephrine without crossing 1 is better than dopamine in the management of sepsis and septic shock. And for adverse events, and definitely we know this for cardiac arrhythmias, again, we can individualize some patients, you know, so they didn't. This is a meta-analysis of all patients. But basically, if the patients have increased risk from dopamine, really should be using levofed. And levofed should be your go-to drug if the unit can go ahead and give that drug. So what about sepsis mortality? It's definitely declining. We know that. So Manny Rivers did his trial, right? Early goal-directed therapy. You guys heard about that trial. It was published in the year 2000. That's already 19 years ago, folks. That's a long time. And all he said was, you know what? If we don't do anything, patients die. If we do a ton of stuff, and Manny did throw a ton of stuff. It was fluids, antibiotics, cultures, a PA catheter, blood transfusions, central venous oxygen monitoring. He did everything. And it was hard to figure out which one of them helped, right? But he did everything. He said, if we do everything, mortality comes down. And Manny's single-center trial was an ED, and it was a mess in there, and the mortality for severe sepsis was in the high 40% range, and he cut it down all the way to 22% by doing something. So he figured doing something timely with a goal, you know, was better than doing nothing. And the Society of Critical Care Medicine, the Surviving Sepsis campaign took off, and everybody said, oh, we got to do all this stuff. At that time, I'm at the University of Miami, and we're sitting there, and we're like, we're not going to do all this stuff. That's crazy. You know, I mean, most people don't even know how to read a PA catheter anymore. So they said, this doesn't even make sense. Can't do all this stuff. But what was employed was the early antibiotics and the fluid resuscitation. And if you look at the mortality on the left upper, what you're seeing is mortality for severe sepsis coming down from 35 to 40%, just like Manny, down between 20 and 25% by the year 2013. You could see it in odds risk of death. It went from 1 being at the start to about 60%. All right, so that's a big cut. Again, this is the Stone Age. We're talking about organ system support and treating infection. It's almost like penicillin again. But you know, we got to do it. So what about the SIRS business? Same trial looked at SIRS. And you know what? For each additional SIRS criteria met, the odds ratio of death increases. So I'm scared I hit this button. I don't know what's going to happen. So if you look here, the odds of death at 1 with 0 SIRS criteria, by the time you get to 4, you're looking at 40-something percent increased risk of death with SIRS criteria. That didn't matter whether you explained them off or not, you know, because they may have come from some other differential diagnosis that the patient had. These are the all-comers with severe sepsis. At the end, patients are recoded with severe sepsis at the end and how they present it. So there is an increased risk. What about blood cultures? Why is it so important? It's super important. These blood cultures before antibiotics, 31.4% positive. You would hope that the number would be bigger, but we know that, you know, blood cultures aren't extremely sensitive. But 31.4 versus if you gave an antibiotic, 19.4%. If you have ID folks in the room, there's no way to de-escalate if we don't know what the heck we're treating. All right, and there's definite risk to all these antibiotics. So this is a big issue, and getting the organism right is a big issue. So we lose 12% of patients with severe sepsis that we won't know what we're treating. And this is severe sepsis. It's a very significant disease process. What about delays in antibiotic therapy? Well, the golden hour. If you have severe sepsis, that first hour, delay increases your risk, about 20% increased risk of death for 1 hour. So this is where I said in severe sepsis, not in sepsis as a whole, in severe sepsis, there's a 1 hour golden rule here that we should be getting cultures and antibiotics done in an hour, which means could there be indiscriminate use of antibiotics in patients that may not have been septic? Absolutely. But do you want to take your chances on patients that have a very high risk of death for the delay? You got to think about it. So you flatten out somewhere in the 30% range, but that fifth and sixth hour then becomes critical also. At that point, your odds risk of death goes twofold for not getting the diagnosis right in the first place. The case we were talking about, if we were past that six-hour point, the patient has a twofold increased risk of death. So we talked about Manny Rivers, and some of you may know these other trials. So these trials came out in 2013, which is PROCESS, ARISE, and PROMISE. And it was like early goal-directed therapy again. They said, okay, this Manny Rivers business with all this stuff is crazy. Let's do this again. Let's do this trial. But the issue is that when they randomized the patients out of the emergency departments, these were academic centers, they randomized the patients, and at that point, they looked at both groups, and they both had received over 30 mL per kilo of ideal body weight fluids and had received early antibiotic therapy. So further randomization towards more early goal-directed therapy, more fluids, didn't make a difference. So then we're left again with what we were talking about, early antibiotics and the 30 ml per kilo. The only groups that benefited, there were two groups, it still crossed one, the odds ratio of one, but the two groups that really leaned towards benefit in these three trials were patients that were intubated, which makes sense. Positive pressure ventilation decreases preload, so they may be a little bit more fluid sensitive. And the other group were those that had not received the full 30 ml per kilo, those who had received less than 20 ml per kilo. Those tended to look like they benefited. So it's a little bit of an argument that the fluids are actually important. So what about this indiscriminate use of antibiotic business? You know, the Surviving Sepsis campaign is pushing this one-hour treatment bundle that I'm talking about, and there is a lot of kickback. I mean, people are saying, really, do we really want to increase our C. diff rates? You know, what is the cost? Are we really looking at that population that wasn't septic that we exposed to antibiotics? Everyone here is big on the symbiosis of our gastrointestinal flora and what that does to the patients and what it could be potentially doing to them, giving them antibiotics that they don't need. So this is an issue, and there's a lot of argument. So I like this clinical decision tool. This tool, in green, you're going to give antibiotics. In red, you're not. In the middle, you're going to be up a creek like the rest of us. But you're going to look at the x-axis, and you're going to look at likelihood of bacterial infection. And the y-axis is basically the illness severity, severity of death, you know, patients in shock, lactic acid, encephalopathy that we know from the QSOFA that we talked about, respiratory failure. Those are the big risks of death. So we look at these patients. Even in patients now with a low likelihood of infection, if you have a very high risk of death for missing that diagnosis, you need a treat. All right? So this doesn't mean expose every single septic patient to antibiotic, but the ones that are severe sepsis, the ones with organ system dysfunction in the ED, just go for it. Blood cultures, antibiotics, de-escalate. You know, that's what you do if it is an infection. But the risk of missing it is high. So it goes back to our case. Think about our young lady. She was 62 years old. She had three search criteria. They're all explainable. But still, even if it was low in your differential, she did have some abdominal complaints. You know what? Abdominal diagnoses and risk for sepsis are super high out of the emergency department. When you see abdominal diagnosis and the patient's risk for death exists, it's treat. The other one is indwelling vascular devices, which she had, which are being accessed too. So her, even though she's fully abdominal, how many of you would have given her vancomycin in the ED once you saw her risk for death? You needed to, because just like the other patient that died, you cover. You can de-escalate afterwards. But those patients, your dialysis patients with access that come in with sepsis, your chemo patients, oncology patients, and abdominal diagnosis, our nurse practitioners in our virtual sepsis unit, those are gimmies. We're going to treat and we're going to de-escalate if it wasn't, because the risk for death is super high. What about CHF? This is what everyone asks me. Oh, but he's got a CHF diagnosis. Oh, he's got an aortic stenosis diagnosis. Oh, but my patient's on dialysis, you know, and they always weigh 45 kilos, and they're coming in at 45 kilos. Well, just because you have a CHF diagnosis doesn't mean that when you get septic, your volume of distribution doesn't increase, right? Your systemic vascular resistance goes down, and you no longer are doing well with that low preload. So your dialysis patient that usually weighs 45 kilos may need to weigh 47 or 48 kilos until their systemic vascular resistance comes back up from the sepsis, from the septic shock that they're in. So they do need fluids. And heart failure patients are also preload dependent. If you have aortic stenosis, you still need preload. All right. So the issue is, if your preload drops, there is room for giving patients fluids, even with these diagnoses. So these patients, when they were included in bundle therapy, actually had diminished mortality. Does that mean that they gave fluids to patients in overt heart failure with RALs in their lungs and JVD going up to their temples? No. That's not the case. That's not what they did. But it means you got to examine your patient. If they're not in overt heart failure, you give them fluid. Do we have to bolus this stuff in 30 minutes as soon as they get into the ED? Not so much. There's no evidence as to how fast we got to give this fluid. All right, what we know is that CMS makes sure that we give it in 6 hours. So it has to be done in 6 hours, otherwise we're going to get dinged. But you know what? You have time. You could give a half a liter if the patient has an AS diagnosis and recheck and re-examine, re-evaluate the patient, give them another liter and see how fluid responsive they are. You could do the passive leg raise if you don't have the tools to look at fluid responsiveness. So there's no association between time of completion of that bolus. But again, CMS, you need to get it done within 6 hours. So if you intend to do it, get it done within 6 hours. Otherwise, we're going to get dinged for it. This is 2018 literature. This is stuff I've been practicing for 15 years, though. I mean, it just makes sense. Normal saline has a chloride of 154 milliequivalents. That is not what my serum looks like. So we have bicarb. That's our other anion. So this normal saline makes a lot of sense, and in most patients that have a good, healthy kidney, you can give them normal saline forever, and you're probably not going to hurt them. But in our severe sepsis patients, their kidneys are not healthy, all right? And you're trying to improve their perfusion. And when you give high chloride, you actually shut down the glomerulus. And so even though you improve volume, and saline has a little bit more salt than lactated ringers, or plasmolite, if you guys use plasmolite, it is actually going to shut down your renal perfusion if the patient starts becoming hyperchloremic. So you have to individualize your patient care. You have to look at their chloride, and you have to decide what fluid they're supposed to get. I did critical care in both medicine and trauma transplant, so I'm familiar with both fluids. You know, it used to be when I was in trauma medicine, it said, oh, lactated ringers, that's something surgeons use. But no, you know, the surgeons were right. You know, when it comes to serum replacement, it looks more like serum than normal saline. Normal saline is just isoosmolar and salt, and it was cheap. But the lactate ringers is pretty cheap. I'll just mention there's no benefit in albumin. The SAFE trial said no benefit. It was no worse. We still use it, yes, for patients that look like their oncotic pressure is going to be very low as a consequence of their other disease processes. But there's really nothing to suggest that it's beneficial, and it's extremely costly. All right. So at the end, was there an outcome difference? Yes. So for critical care patients, not in the less sick patients, in the critical care patients, they had lower composite outcome of death, new renal replacement therapy, or persistent renal dysfunction than the use of saline. So this makes sense. I think everybody knows it. It's been preached over the last year and a half since the studies came out. So fluid responsiveness. I don't know what tools you all are using for fluid responsiveness, but I get it. We get a lot about fluid responsiveness. So I would say you do the 30 ml per kilo, right? But then afterwards, there's patients that people want to keep giving fluids to. I would state, well, the literature says definitely be on pressors if you're still hypotensive at that point. But if you want to continue giving fluids, I really suggest that you look at a reason to do it or have something to guide you. The fluid responsive tools are stuff like stroke volume variation or cardiac output monitors, things that let us know that the patients are actually benefiting from those fluids, because fluids are harmful. And although we didn't see any benefit in the other trials for increasing fluids after the initial 30 ml per kilo, we definitely have seen a lot of detriment. So fluid creep. This is what we're talking about. So initially, when you're septic, we're talking about, let's say, that dialysis patient, you need to rescue the patient. You give fluid, you improve their volume of distribution, and you kind of keep them in an optimized, stabilized section where they stay euvolemic at that point. You've increased the tank the most you can. I will make another pitch here. Just because they're fluid responsive after 30 ml per kilo may not mean that it's good to keep giving them fluid. So we have some of these patients I've monitored in the ICU. They're always fluid responsive. The monitor always says the SVV is greater than 13% if you guys follow stroke volume variation. And you want to keep pouring fluid into these people, but the patient looks like a Zeppelin, all right, at that point. And you know that the intra-abdominal pressure and the compartment syndrome is developing. There's pleural effusions affecting your vent, yet your monitor says they're fluid responsive. Just keep in mind, there's no literature stating that following fluid responsive tools past the 30 ml per kilo is beneficial. All right, but it's something we do, so I say at minimum use it, because if they're not, please don't give any more fluid. So then comes this new term called deresuscitation. Once that systemic vascular resistance actually improves, right, and the patient's no longer in this distributive shock, we need to help them remove that fluid because their kidneys are usually dinged. So if they have ATN or they're a dialysis patient, it's time to do some slow continuous ultrafiltration or give them a diuretic if they're responsive. But that fluid is harmful. Once that SVR comes back, all right, those patients are not benefiting from the fluid. It's increasing interstitial pressures, and it's diminishing nutrition and flow across the body, and it's diminishing your ability to take them off a ventilator, and the intra-abdominal fluid definitely is deleterious once it builds pressure. There's a potential for harm here. If you look at number 5, if you over-diurese these patients or do the ultrafiltration a little too fast and you de-resuscitate the patient too fast, you're going to hit their kidneys again and you're going to hurt that patient too. I would tell you that those tools that we talked about, fluid responsive tools, this is the time to use them. If you're going to help your patients de-resuscitate more than they're going to do on their own by just urinating, if you're going to do anything on that point, at that point, use those tools. And you can actually, I do it, I go ahead and put my ultrafiltration rate next to my stroke volume variation, and I make sure that the patient's cardiac output's not being dinged by the fluid removal that we're doing with that patient. So that way you're targeting your fluid removal and your deresuscitation for that group of patients. So after the hemodynamic stabilization, basically conserve fluids, diuresis, and some patients may need RRT in order to get them off. And is there evidence for this? Yes. So if you had a conservative or deresuscitated fluid strategy, you know, versus the usual care, these patients had more vent-free days, decreased length of ICU, you know, compared to that standard management. And that fluid creep, I'm sure you've seen it. I've been preaching it since I was faculty at the University of Miami. I would go by and I would ask the resident, why are you on maintenance fluid? And I used to love asking them this all the time. I said, how many grams of salt are in 1 liter normal saline? And they never could answer. It's funny, we all did chemistry, but it's 9 grams. They said, and he's a hypertensive patient, right? How many grams of salt is his diet? You say you're giving him a 2 gram sodium diet, and yet you're giving him 9 grams, probably 2.5 bags a day at 100 ml an hour. You got to think about it. 6% of the fluid given in the hospital is actually the resuscitation fluid. It doesn't put the patients into trouble to resuscitate them at 30 ml per kilo. The Zeppelin that you see in that bed 3 or 4 days later, that's maintenance fluid. That's fluids given with drugs, all right? And that's fluids given orally with the flushes. So it's only 6% to resuscitate these patients. It's the biggest argument I get against resuscitation. Oh, but we're going to put them in volume overload. It's 6%. The volume overload occurs because we go on past that 30 ml per kilo. You guys, I don't know how your Cerner looks, but you know, we went ahead and built these power plants for doing the evidence-based care for sepsis. That was one of the things that we did that was great. It includes the 30 ml per kilo ideal body weight. It includes calculators for ideal body weight in there. It includes the antibiotics of choice for the patients. It includes the pre-check, lactic acid, the cultures, whatever it is needs to be done, all pre-checked. Because at the end, I feel that we all know what to do. It's been hammered down, but the actual piece of actually mechanizing the care and getting it done is the difficulty. So I don't want to take up too much more time. These are things that we have built through EBCC that we'd like to share, and I think that we're working on sharing in the Cerner here. And summary, when we're going to build this virtual sepsis unit, we're in talks and getting it set up here with you all, too, to help you with the coordination. It's not intrusive to physician management. We're letting the physicians and the APPs manage the patients and the residents manage the patients, but we're just going to keep an eye on the orders. And if the orders don't meet the goals, we'll just have a conversation. Did you really mean to only give a liter, or were we going for 30 ml per kilo? And it's just a way to track the patients so that intended care actually gets done. The other piece I'd put on the summary is to just think sepsis. If it's within the differential and the patient's at risk for dying from it, treat it, de-escalate later. I'm going to hand off to Dr. Cata Jimenez. Dr. Jimenez is our documentation specialist, and this is important, and I'll just give a little thing of why. When you look at mortality for sepsis, the numerator is your deaths. And I'll tell you what, your abstractors will query every death and it will be clean. For sure, all the sepsis stuff will be in there and they'll make sure all the documentation is right. But your denominator, right, is all your sepsis cases, right? And what I notice as I go through our system is that sometimes I look at sepsis with low severity of illness in our ICU. How could that even be? Patients in our ICU should have high severity of illness. The problem is our documentation. So if your documentation is poor, that means your denominator is not right. The mortality of your system is going to look a lot higher than it really should. So we really need to capture all cases so that we show you the true good work that you guys are doing. So we're going to try to help you be compliant with all your processes. But the other piece also, you know, needs to be good documentation. And Kata is our specialist at this.
So good morning. My name is Katia Jimenez. I'm the corporate manager for clinical documentation improvement in the whole system in Baptist Health South Florida. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the documentation piece of sepsis. So we must understand that our clinical language is not exactly the same as when HIM captures that. Coders are not clinical. they are translators. They are taking your notes and translating them into alphanumeric codes. So if you write it incorrectly, the translation is probably going to be off. And that's why the end result is probably not the appropriate clinical picture for that particular patient. So that's why we emphasize about this whole documentation thing and how coding influences your data. So like I said, coders are not clinical. They are translators. So you need to be very clear into what you want to say in order for them to capture the appropriate clinical picture. And as you know, the data that's coded is the data that's reported. CMS and all these payers, they're not analyzing your medical records. They're not reading through your notes. All they're doing is analyzing claims data. And all the data that's in claims is ICD-10 codes. So if HIM is capturing incorrectly, then probably your patients are all incorrect if they're not capturing the appropriate codes. Obviously, this data impacts in financial, in reimbursement, in quality, and obviously public reporting. What happens is that the documentation that you have, we know you're giving quality care. We all know that. Nobody's questioning the quality of care that you're providing. It's just that when you're documenting, it's not proving that quality of care, and it's not proving how sick those patients are. So a couple of tips in regards to sepsis. If you think it, document it. You have the whole hospitalization to make up your mind as to what the patient has or what the patient doesn't have. If somebody has it, you can think it. The terminology such as suspected, possible, probable, likely, questionable in the inpatient world is all valid. If you write that, it means that the patient had it. All you have to do is confirm it in the discharge summary. And then you're set. If you think somebody had something, you suspect something, and then you figure out the patient doesn't have it, then rule it out. All you have to do is document that you don't think that patient has that anymore. You rule it out, and then you remove it from your problem list. The problem list is a problem. You need to, that list is makes what HIM calls conflicting documentation. If you think something at the beginning and you remove it and you think it's not there anymore and you don't remove it from the problem list, it carries on all the way until the end. So the coder is conflicted as to should she code it or not. So that's why I'm saying about the clear, concise documentation. Do not use sepsis syndrome, ural sepsis, or SIRS. So sepsis syndrome does not code to sepsis, so don't utilize that verbiage. Urosepsis is definitely not, please don't use it. That's not even an ICD-10 code. When you document urosepsis, what happens is, since there's no ICD-10 code, HIM takes what's most specified within the hospitalization. So if in that case was a urinary tract infection, that patient will end up leaving here with a urinary tract infection. And if the patient dies, you kill the patient with a urinary tract infection because you didn't document appropriately. SIRS, there's an issue with the SIRS. So back when we had ICD-9, there used to be a code for SIRS due to infectious source. But when we switch to ICD-10, CMS is in charge of changing, adding ICD-10 codes and modifying every fiscal year. They modify everything. So they said, well, if the patient has SIRS with an infectious source, then it must be sepsis. So they removed that diagnosis. So if you document a patient with an infection, such as pneumonia, urinary tract infection, whatever, and you happen to document SIRS, HIM cannot code that SIRS, so that severity is lost. So you need to make up your mind. If, in fact, it's sepsis, then you document the sepsis. With sepsis, it's important to document the present on admission status. You might not know the patient has sepsis, or you don't have the clear clinical picture until maybe the second or the third day where you start documenting sepsis. The thing is that HIM takes into consideration what's present on admission, what's documented in the admission note. So if you happen to document something that was present on admission afterwards, they will place a POA status of no. And that means that the care that you provided Well, this is what it looks like in data. It means that you had that patient for 3 days, and the care that you provided was not probably accurate, so the patient went into sepsis. So if the patient did indeed have a clinical picture of sepsis since the beginning, and you figure it out, and you document it on the third or fourth day, you just write sepsis present on admission. That will clear up, and that will get that documentation to say POA yes. You always try to link the sepsis with the source of infection, and if the microorganism is known, also document. Coders cannot code from diagnostic tests. Coders cannot code from laboratory testing. So, for example, I get a lot from cardiologists, well, the ejection fraction is there in the, you know, the ejection fraction might be there, but if it's not documented within the record, they cannot code if it's systolic or diastolic heart failure. So the same thing with the sepsis. If you have blood cultures positive, you document the microorganism so that way it can get coded. You also link the infectious source to the sepsis. If you already know if it's multifactorial, well, it's multifactorial, but it's important that you link it. The same with the severe sepsis and the organ dysfunctions. So there, for ICD-10, there's only three codes. There's sepsis, and severe sepsis with septic shock. The thing is that if you don't document severe sepsis, the coder can't code it. The coder cannot assume that just because the patient has acute kidney failure with acute tubular necrosis that that's due to the sepsis. It's not unless you say it so. So if you say that that acute kidney failure with acute tubular necrosis is due to that sepsis, then they can code severe sepsis. Either you link an organ dysfunction to the sepsis, or you document severe sepsis, and then they can be able to place that in the coding. We must try to stay away from signs and symptoms and laboratory values. It's best to document diagnoses. The thing is that signs and symptoms are what they call, they're in the category of R codes, so they're kind of descriptors, but they don't actually state how sick that patient is. So it's important to try and get as many diagnoses there as possible, if the patient has it, of course. So if the patient is hypoxemic, don't write hypoxemia. That's a laboratory result. You have to, if it's a respiratory failure, then document a respiratory failure. If you want to specify as hypoxic, it's fine. Hypercapnic, fine. But if you write the word failure, it's good. If this is a favorite of altered mental status or confusion, if the patient is confused, is it an encephalopathy? And please specify it, because encephalopathy in itself, 2 fiscal years ago, they switched it. CMS changes the rules every year. So encephalopathy on its own doesn't hold as much severity as if you further specify it. So if it's a toxic encephalopathy, document. If it's a metabolic, document it. If the patient is bedridden or bedbound, that's a status code too. It's a descriptor, but it's not actually stating how sick that patient is. If you get a lot of patients from nursing homes or old, you can document functional quadriplegia. If you don't know what that is, you can write immobility due to old age. Severe immobility due to old age or frailty, and that codes to that, and that's a major comorbid condition. If you have a patient that's frail, debility, cachexia, is the patient malnourished? If you have a nutrition department, they should be using Aspen criteria to be able to diagnose these patients. If there's severe malnutrition, that's a major comorbid condition, and it holds a lot of weight with severity of illness. So if you have it, document it. We need to make sure that the patient meets criteria, though, because that's a heavily audited diagnosis. So if you have the nutrition department that's really trained, then use their notes and you have that support. If the case is audited, then you have the support of that, of the nutrition consult. If the patient is hypotensive, is it a shock? And if it's a shock, please specify which shock. So if it's distributor shock, distributor shock? Is it hypotensive? Is it septic? It's very important to further specify these diagnoses, and that holds a lot of weight with the whole mortality. If the patient's in the denominator, we need to show or make sure we show how sick this patient is. Because if the patient dies, then at least it's proof, okay, the patient died because the patient had to die because he had all of these comorbidities. So this is why it's so important. So if you guys have any questions, thank you.